the strongest voices for the ethic of Alcoholics Anonymous and the preservation of its principles, Clancy I from Venice, California.
My name is Clancy Immerslin, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm very glad to be here tonight, glad to be part of this retreat. I was a little doubtful about it when Bob called me about it, but it's much better than he described it. It's been a remarkable weekend. We've had some outstanding talks. Sandy, last night, talking on the steps. I always admire his command of thought and language and his ability to express it in analogies that are quite clear. And this morning, enjoyed very much hearing the Hispanic lady. I wouldn't mention her name. She's gone home. She's ill. She sent me a note. And she's ill, and she's Angie, dear lady. She has bad asthma. She went home. But she was here, and Ralph gave such an outstanding talk this morning. Where's he now? He's gone too? God, they're piling out of here like rats. You can bet Tom Ivester's here. Because he's going to talk next, that's why. Anyway. And Clint gave a fine talk today on the 6th and 7th steps, and very much enjoyed Sharon's talk on the steps. And this is all very nice. You say, isn't that beautiful speakers? In fact, it would be nice if they had a lineup of speakers like that at the International Convention instead of what they have. They had Tom, but that's a start. But they need a little more than... They should get people like they've had today and tonight and last night. But that's not the impressive thing about this. I go to places, a lot of places, I hear great speakers, and I've some wonderful speakers that are inspiring and so on. You can hear them a lot of places. What's inspiring about this place is that the attenders are all on the same page. There's never been anything like that, as far as I know, in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, where there's been hundreds of people, all activists from far and near, who all believe in the same general principles and are getting together to enhance their belief and to associate with one another. This is absolutely a remarkable one-time thing, and we're all very fortunate to be here. And we can hang it on Bill Wilson's birthday tomorrow, whatever we hang it on. But it is it's a remarkable thing. And I know there's some newer people here. I just want to talk for just a few minutes a little bit about how lucky we are to be here. Most of us know this, you know, but there seem to be types of alcoholics. We don't talk about it much, but there are types. There seems to be a type of alcoholic by any way you measure them. They're alcoholic. They drink and they get in trouble. They can't stop. And something happens that really threatens their security. Maybe a death in the family, or lose a job, or lose a family. And they quit. And they never drink again. And there's all kinds of people roaming around like that. And the same type of people, when they become addicted to alcohol, need medical withdrawal. These are the people for whom treatment centers were originally created. And these people sometimes don't understand how lethal alcoholic addiction is, much more lethal than drug addiction. Has been said by authorities, you put 50 alcoholics, addicted alcoholics, and 50 addicted drug addicts in a room, and in 10 days you open that door, you're going to have 50 awfully sick drug addicts and about 25 dead alcoholics. Because that's where all the terrible things that happen, the spasms, the attacks, the delirium tremens, all the various things that happen. But these people go to treatment centers, and they're led by one step by step, withdrawn from their alcohol addiction. They're shown the error of their ways, and they quit, and they never drink again. In fact, up in Seattle, Schick Shadel, very famous hospital, advertises that, and they do it. They're absolutely correct. They say, We will remove your alcoholism in less than 30 days. And they do it. They have a long list of names for whom they've done it. People like us, gay as a gas tenant. How could that be? Because that's a type of alcoholic. Then there's another type of alcoholic which seems to be an alcoholic by any way you measure it. They drink too much, or they can't stop drinking. They have problems, and something happens that really threatens their security, and they quit. But they always eventually drink again, sooner or later. And this same type of alcoholic comes out of treatment centers with tears of sincerity rolling down their cheeks, and they know they've had enough. But they eventually always drink again and again and again. And these are the type of alcoholics that have baffled science and medicine and psychology and psychiatry and families. Families most often, I suppose. I've often thought if you could, most everyone in this room, I'm sure, who's an alcoholic has studied that phenomenon of looking at someone's face who loves you and seeing that terrible look of disappointment. And that, oh, how could you? You were doing so well. And the children were doing better. And now look at you. How could you do that? And that really rips you up. So you have to say things like, oh, shut up and leave me alone, God damn it. It sounds funny, but it isn't funny at all. It's the cry of someone who has no... I'm saying, I don't know either. I don't know either. Leave me alone. And these are the people that for written records of 4,000 years have baffled everybody. One time they thought they were possessed by the devils and something would be put to death and flogged and whipped and put in prisons and jails and nut houses, and England would send them to colonies, send them to Australia, get them out of here. Just, there's no hope for these type of people. And when I was born and a little boy in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, after 4,000 years, there still was no place for people like this to help be helped. There's the Keeley cure where they made you sick by drinking, but you stopped, you know, as soon as you found a place where they didn't put stuff in the booze, you could drink again. And they never had any cure. And that's the background of this strange story that we've heard a couple, Sanders told a little bit last night, I'll just tell you a little bit tonight, about this family in New York, very wealthy family, manufacturing family, had a big manufacturing firm, they had a son who's going to take over the firm. And he seemed to be troubled by nerves, a nervous disease of some sort. He'd get terribly nervous. And when he got terribly nervous, he would drink, and he would drink too much. And his parents thought, if we could get rid of this nervous condition, we'll probably be able to help him. And so most of us know the story, but here's a little Philip you may not know. They decided to contact the best doctor in the world to help him. And the first one they contacted was Dr. Freud. And Dr. Freud refused to take the case. And that's the first break we ever got. We could be sitting here tonight drunk and saying, but I dreamt I was sober. Instead, they went to see Dr. Jung. They had a couple friends take him to Dr. Jung in Switzerland. And Dr. Jung, as Sandy told us so well last night, put him in a sanitarium and worked with him every day to break through the walls that were causing this emotional upset, his conflicts. And at the end of a year, he felt he had really understood the nature of his problem, sent him home. And he went to, stopped in Paris before he took the ship with some wealthy members of his, friends of his family. And they toasted his new life. And 3 days later, he was drunk, face down again. Nobody could understand why. He was supposed to be all well. So they took him back to Dr. Jung and said, we don't know what happened to Roland, but he seemed to have a little upset. And Dr. Jung, as we know, refused to take him back, which was a funny little break for us. I'll tell you, if he'd have taken him back, we might not be here today. But he didn't take him back. And he said, Roland, I have misdiagnosed your case. He said, in effect, I thought I could help you with the deep-seated emotional problems you had, but I see now that you are what is known as a chronic alcoholic. And to the best of my knowledge, there is no effective treatment for your condition today in the world at any price. Now, this is a bad piece of news to get. And Roland said, well, what does this mean, doctor? And the doctor said, what it means, Roland, he said, in effect, you must either keep yourself confined for the rest of your life, or you almost certainly will intermittently drink to excess until you die or go mad. And Roland said, my God, is there any way out? And the doctor said, yes, in my readings, I read of some cases where there's been some sort of involuntary psychological reversion. They call it a spiritual experience. He said, very rare, very hard to get. I wouldn't plan that you'd look for one. I suggest that you do what I say, Roland. And Roland came home. Didn't stop in Paris for dinner this time. And he got in the ship, and on that ship, he apparently did what all of us have to do somewhere along the line, although we don't know it. He surrendered to the fact that he had no hope. And he cast about, it just started a series of funny little coincidences. Any one of them, if they hadn't happened just the way they did, we wouldn't be here tonight. That's what's so spooky about it. He was a vestryman of the Presbyterian Church. And he had been very active in church work. And yet he thought, how can I get to be one of these spiritual, at least a spiritual degree? And there was a thing called the Oxford Movement going on. And it was a kind of a big fad at the time. What most of us don't know is that it was the only period of its success in that decade. There's not before or since. What happened was, in 1912, a Lutheran minister in Pennsylvania felt that the Christians of the world were not devoting enough of their lives to Christianity, were not willing to take inconvenience and pain. And he wanted them to be like the Christians in the first century who would be willing to be crucified for their belief. And he started an organization called the First Century Christian Association. And it didn't go over very well. You know, who wants to be crucified? But it was a lot of rigorous application. But later on, he went to England and tried to peddle it. And for some reason or other, the students and faculty at Oxford University really were fascinated by it. And they took it on as their will. And it became known as the Oxford Group, the Oxford Movement. And he brought it back to the United States in the late 1920s as the Oxford Group. Now it had a little panache, a little something to go with it. And all over the country for the next few years, growing numbers of small groups of well-to-do, intelligent people would get together and discuss spiritual values. The best equivalent I can think of, if you're old enough to remember the Earhart seminar training, where people would get together and discuss psychological things. These are spiritual things, and they were fine people, and they were really quite advanced. They weren't people coming off the street. And in fact, 1929 is when they first began to take hold of the United States again. By 1937, they were almost extinct, because the minister had been fascinated by the way Germany seemed to be so efficient, and he admired them, so the Oxford people asked him to stop using his name, because he is such a German believer, they thought. And he changed his name to the Moral Rearmament Movement, and still little tiny dribblets today. But in that nine-year period, it really functioned and flourished. And if it hadn't, we wouldn't be here. But anyway, he decided to go join the Oxford Movement. And he wrote later, he said, I wanted to stay sober as long as I could. So my parents, when I died, my parents would have a memory of me being sober. But it sounds kind of tough. And a few years later, when he died drunk, his parents had a memory of me being sober for quite a while. But he got active in the Oxford Movement and really enjoyed it and did very well and has gotten back into business and doing well and helping people. And his family were so pleased. They said, you know, you're doing so well. Why don't you take some time off and go up to Vermont, our country home where we used to have always spent our summers? And he went to Vermont, and he had a good time, saw some old friends. And he came back to New York for pick up some affairs. Then he went back to Vermont, and he got there just the nick of time. If he'd have waited one more week, we wouldn't be here. It's just scary. Because when he got there this time, they said, you know, our childhood friend that you knew when you visited up here as a child, Evie, has really been a bad drinker. Could you talk to him? He said, sure, I'll try. And they brought Ebby, and he tried to tell him about the Oxford movies. I'd want to hear that religious crap. Come on, Roland. And that was the end of that. And later that week, Ebby ran his car drunk into somebody's house. And he was arrested and taken to court. And the judge's son came to see Roland and said, you know, Ebby's a nice guy. It's just this terrible drinking. And you should understand that, because you drank like that. And I talked to my dad about it. He won't listen to me. He'll listen to you because he's a friend of your father's, and he knows you, and he knows what you've done. He said, would you please come to court and testify for Ebby? He said, I'll try. And he went to court, and the judge, a couple guys went with him, but the judge looked at Roland and said, well, I know you, and I know your father, and only because you're here, I'll release Ebby to your custody. But as you say, you must take him out of the state of Vermont. I don't want him here, because he's going to the penitentiary. So Roland, because he happened to be there, took Ebby out of there. If he hadn't gotten there that week, Ebby would have been in the penitentiary, and we would have been God knows where. We took him back to New York and put him in a kind of a Oxford-supported mission down on Broadway. And he got caught up in it a little bit. He stayed sober for a while. He felt pretty good, and things were going good. There's novelty of it staying sober. And after a while, what they had to do in the Oxford movement is that when you stayed, they weren't there to be sober. They were there to find spiritual values. And when you were there a few months, you were supposed to go out and testify to someone what you had found. And Roland said, well, Ebby, it's time to go out and testify. And he said, I don't believe I want to testify. He said, you want to go back to Vermont? No, I don't think so. I think I'll testify. So he thought, who could I testify to? And he happened to think of this mooch from Vermont that he'd known was even a bigger mooch than he was, living off his wife, used to be a big shot and lorded over people. Now he's just a mooch in Brooklyn. He made a point of trying to find him. So I'll testify to him. He won't even remember it. And he got a hold of this mooch, Bill Wilson, over in Brooklyn, and they made an arrangement for him to go over and see him. Now, our book describes Bill's version of that. Went to the door, this clean-cut, nice-looking guy. Said, how come you're doing so well? He said, I found religion, which made Bill feel bad. But there's a little more to it than that. I heard Ebby talk a few years ago, and he talked at the International Convention, as a matter of fact, 1960. That's a few years ago. Jesus. It all kind of goes fast after a while. But he talked about coming in and sitting down with Bill and telling him about the Oxford movement. And Bill just sat and drank as fast as he could. That's really wonderful, Ebby. And that offended Ebby, you know, to be treated like that by this mooch. So one thing Bill did not ever write in the book, but really happened. Ebby came back 2 or 3 days later. And he had the Oxford group closer with him. I want to talk to you, Mr. Wilson, about the Oxford group. And Bill thought he was a goof. And shortly thereafter went off one of the great drunks of all time. He started off to see Ebby at the mission over there and got drunk on the way. By the time he got there, he decided to say a few words, but Ebby was gone, so he got staggered out down the street. Just a mess and a drunken bum again. And wound up back at the hospital, town's hospital. And his doctor called his wife and said, Mrs. Wilson, he said, your husband's here, but I want to tell you, he won't be coming back again here very often. He'll be dead. He's very close to not making it this time. And she was in such dismay. And by a stroke of luck, among Bill's papers was Ebby's phone number at the mission. And she called up Ebby and said, Ebby, Bill is back in the hospital. Could you talk to him? And Ebby went up there with a couple of friends. And they said, Bill, you got to find this. I've got to find a higher power that'll help you. And I don't want to hear that, Jesus. He'd been up there a couple of days by this time, so sick. That night, in the middle of that, we all know this story so well. He knelt by there. He just cried out, God, if you're there, let me make yourself known, Jesus. And as he said, all of a sudden, a big light filled the room, it seemed like. The wind blew through his ears. He thought he was going insane for sure. And he said, my God. And he went away and he told the doctor about it. He said, have I cracked, doctor? Am I gone? He said, no. I don't know what it is, but you've, whatever it is, you stick with it because you look different. And he came out of there and went to the Oxford group. And I think, what's all the deal about Roland and Ebby and all this crap? He would, could have happened to him anyway. It very likely would have, maybe. But the very few people who ever had those spiritual experiences, they associated them with the church and would get active in church work. He associated with the Oxford group and stopped drinking. So he went to the Oxford group. And he decided to help people stop drinking. He had a call to help people stop drinking. And for the next few months, he tried to help people, pick up street people and take them to the Oxford Group meetings. You know, and these people at the Oxford Group try to be nice, but they're rather well-to-do, conservative people. Here's some old fool, drunk, sick, sitting in. I believe you're vomiting on my shoe, sir. Yeah. And sometimes you'd take them home and let them stay overnight, and you'd, as was said earlier this weekend, try to teach them religion. Tell them you can get this spiritual experience if you pray hard enough, and God will help you. And he said, I don't want to hear that. What guy in the street wants to hear about how God's going to make it better? And one morning he got up after a few months, and the guy he'd brought home the night before apparently had gotten up earlier and stolen some stuff out of the kitchen to sell for wine and left. And he looked at his wife, who'd been a pert, charming young society girl, now prematurely old, prematurely gray almost, putting on her sweater with a patch on the sleeve to go to work in a cheap department store so she could make enough dollars so Bill could go out and save the world. And he realized what a cataclysm his life had been. And he looked at her and said, Lois, I'm so sorry. I am so sorry. I thought I had a calling to help these people, but I'm done doing it. I'm somehow going to get a job. I'm not going to do this anymore. It's going to be better, honey. He said, I've been trying to help these people for 6 months, and not one person has stayed sober, and I said, I'm quit. And she, right then, our meeting tonight hung by about as thin a thread as ever going to hang. And she turned to him and said something that changed the course of history. I was having lunch with her a number of years ago in Connecticut. I said, how did you ever think that answer, Lois? God, you just changed the course of history. She said, I don't know. It seems so obvious that I don't know a way to understand it. He said, not one person has stayed sober. And she said, you did. He said, oh, yeah. That's why old-timers don't have much hair in front. You just go through. Everything is, oh, yeah. And so he's trying to do it again. And then we all know the story. They're going to give him one more chance now. He'd been a stockbroker. They thought he could really do some good. So they're going to give him one chance now. He's sober. Maybe you can believe in him. Going to send him out to Akron to put this deal together. He'd become president of this company. He's going to be wonderful. And, of course, the deal blew up in his face, and he stood in Akron, the Mayflower Hotel. Most all of us know that story, I'm sure. Stood there, and he reached in his pocket. He had $10 on Saturday. He could either pay off the hotel or he could take a train home. And, God, what could he do? The deal had blown up. You'd go home to failure again and abject humiliation. And I stood in that lobby a few years ago trying to recreate that moment. I'm kind of a romanticist. And over there was a door. Over the door was a curved little sign that said, cocktails. And he, as he announced, said later, you know, I kind of felt if I just had a drink or two, I could figure out a way to do something. And he started to walk. And your life and mine went right along with him, boy. And he happened to see these telephones in the lobby. Do you remember? He promised to call somebody. We all know this story. He went through and found Dr. Tunk and called somebody who put him in touch with a wealthy woman who happened to be home, thank God, because he wouldn't have waited much longer. He'd been stiff by about 5 calls already. And she called a drunken doctor's wife, and thank God they were home. And she was able to get back to him and say, come out to my home tomorrow. And so the next day he came out there and met this doctor. And the doctor, and he talked. And so impressed the doctor that the doctor invited him to stay with him for a while and discuss the Oxford movement, how he was able to stay sober. And Bill had nowhere to get home and pay the hotel bill both, so he agreed, I'll stay, you bet. And he stayed with him, and after 2 weeks the doctor went to American Medical Association convention in Atlantic City. He said, I'm so glad to go there. Last year I was there, I was drunk, and they laughed at me. And I'll go this time, and I'll show them what happened. And Monday, the office nurse called at 6 in the morning, called his house, and said, Mrs. Smith, I'm so sorry. They carried the doctor off the train this morning so drunk he couldn't walk. He was laying on the platform. The station agent called me. I went down, got him. He's on the floor of the office. I'm so sorry. And then she and Bill went down and got him, brought him home. And we all know that story, too, about he lay in bed a couple days so sick. And one morning he woke up and said, oh, my God, I'm so sick. What's the date today? What day is it? It's Wednesday, Bob. Oh, my God. I've got to do a surgery, a cancer surgery. Look at my hand. I can't do it. My God, my God. And they got him up and bathed him and put his clothes on, and Bill bought him some booze so his hand would stop. They took him out of the hospital, dropped him off, went home to wait for him. He should have been home about 1:30 or 2. And they waited at 2, he wasn't home, and 3, he wasn't home, and 4, he wasn't home, and 5, he wasn't home. And it just became so clear, God, he did it again. He's done it again. All of a sudden, the car whipped up the driveway, and Bob came bounding in. He said, I just feel like $1 million. Well, he said, where you been, Bob? He said, oh, God, all this time they've been telling the Oxford group I should make amends to people I've hurt. I didn't think a doctor should have to make amends, but I realize I have to do it too. I've been all over town making amends to people, and I feel wonderful. And that day was the beginning of Alcoholics Anonymous, June 10th. And we know how that worked. They went up and got some guy, found a guy in the hospital, Bill D. from Drunken Lawyer. And little by little, they got some people, lost a lot of people too. My favorite story was that Ernie, young guy, first young guy to come to AA, or it wasn't AA, there's the Oxford group, of course. And they had a little wing of the drinker wing of the Oxford group. And Ernie did something that all of us have had to pay a terrible price for. It. He fell in love with Dr. Bob's daughter and brought us our first relationship. I don't know any word that more sends a shiver down the spine of anybody except, I want to talk to you about my new relationship. Oh, Jesus. You just need an aha machine and put the phone on it and walk away. And they fell in love and they got married. And that sounds so wonderful, doesn't it? And that happened in my family. My daughter Susan, some of you know, fell in love with the guy I sponsored. I was not in favor of that wedding, I'll tell you. But the women of the family overruled me. And they got married. Now, I want to give you the textbook example of a mixed emotion. It's watching your daughter go down the aisle to marry a man whose fifth step you've heard. You can't really say anything, but you can give hints, you know. Let me know if he ever brings a sheep home, honey. And they gave him a rest from having to do the things they were doing, all this running around in the ashram. But they said, you better stay home and take care of your wife. You have to do the things we're doing. So they were upset when he got drunk and died and turned her against AA for 50 years or so. But hey, well, the story after that, it grew. Bill went back to New York, got a little group going there, got a little group in Akron. Late 1937, they said, maybe we should do something more. If we could help more people, they decided to write a book. And in 1938, Bill Wilson wrote this book, which we've heard described so expertly this weekend. And if you're kind of new, you know, you may wonder why you have not seen the wonderfulness in the book that they have seen, these people who have been speaking. Because for many people, it's an acquired wisdom. I know when I first came to AA in 1949, my sponsor had me read the book. And I read it. And they say it's a badly written book. It isn't a badly written book. It's just tedious, boring, tedious book. Some years later, when I came off Skid Row and went back to AA again, my new sponsor had me read the book, and this time I found it even more tedious. Because I'd been in the business of advertising and writing in big advertising agencies and do this, buy this product, take this action, run it around. And you read that book, you'd read nothing. If you are thorough at this stage of your development. So I found the book to be rather dull. It used to be offending when people said, this book is a real miracle. Miracle. Why is it a miracle schmiracle? And I'll tell you, not only that, but the guy, here's this book, they call it a miracle. They use the word miracle very loosely in AA a lot. But it is unlikely. for several reasons. One, it was written by a guy 3 years sober who was surrounded more by failure than success. Most of the people didn't stay. We don't think about that. We think everybody came with him or stayed sober. Not at all. Most of them didn't. And he had no background in psychology, no background in any meaningful religious philosophy, no background in abnormal psychology, no background in anything. And he wrote this book. Not only wrote this book, but submitted it chapter by chapter to a bunch of people to evaluate. If there's any way to get a bad book, it's to write a chapter and submit it to a committee to look at. You know the old joke, a camel is a horse made by a committee. That's just, I think it should have a hump there. Yes, that'd be a good idea. And he'd send it up to Akron, and then makes their, I don't think that's right, and then send it back. They finally got this book, and they published it in 1939. And they're going to sell a lot of books and build hospitals for alcoholics. Change the face of life. And the book did not sell at all, which just saved us again from falling into some hideous thing. And they sold about 50 books the first 6 months, that's all. And they had a terrible time with it. And so they, but you think, today you'll hear again and again people say, this book is a miracle. Now, why is this book a miracle? Now, you've heard some excellent speakers this weekend taking portions of that book and pointing out how true and how absolutely, almost deeply motivating this book is. And when you're around a while, you begin to see that. Because this book has one odd characteristic. It gets smarter every year you're here. It gets meanings more and more. Very few newcomers are taken by it. But as the old-timers get to, my God, look at that. As Sharon said, page 77, was that there before? Yeah, it was. And just on and on. And this guy wrote this book when he was 3 years sober without any knowledge. And most people feel it had to be inspired. He didn't know if to write it. He was 3 years sober. You know, sometimes new people say, oh my God, 3 years sober. Should know enough to write a book by then. By the time you're 3 years sober, you don't know enough to write a book. By the time you're 5 years sober, you just try to be nice to people 3 years sober. Keep coming back, Jimmy. You're doing a good job. By the time you're 10 years sober, you hate to send people 3 years sober to get your coffee. Was that one cream and two sugars or one sugar? Never mind, I'll get it myself. By the time you're 20 years sober, you hate to have people 3 years sober unattended on your property. You want to see how they're going to turn out. But this book became a cornerstone. And Bill Wilson, they finally got some juice, got a little publicity in Liberty Magazine, which was a magazine at that time, and they made it sound like a religion, and it did didn't help, but probably hurt it a lot, because it seemed to be such a religious cult. And then the Saturday Evening Post sent their ace reporter, who had just got done writing an article on the corruption in the labor movement and the Philadelphia docks. His new movement is to blow the whistle on this Alcoholics Anonymous. And he, Reverend, much too surprised, found it the way it was supposed to be, of course. Traveled all over, went to St. Louis. He was from St. Louis, actually, but we went to St. Louis, New York, Philadelphia, everywhere. And wrote this glowing article in the Saturday Evening Post, 1941. All of us know about that in March. And AA really took off. For the first time in history, people found out there might be some place for my drunken husband, my drunken wife, my drunken friend to go, because it can get some help. And AA just blossomed everywhere, just all of a sudden groups all over. But then, after a year or two, Bill Wilson would sit in his office, and one by one the letters start coming in. Our group folded. Our group's gone. All of our members are getting drunk. One by one, we're fighting and we're having hassles and we're having a lot of problems. And people were having problems. And there was such antipathy. For example, the people in Chicago hated the AAs in New York, would never do them, just write to Akron. People in Los Angeles had nothing to do with Akron. They only write to New York. People all over the country choosing up sides and fighting and debating and how much can you do. And Bill was frantic. the end of 1944, early 1945, in an effort to bring some unity, founded the Grapevine, a tabloid size, this size, and issued that, and that didn't help much. And his letters kept coming in. And in 1945, a guy in North Carolina wrote an article for the Grapevine, sent it to Bill Wilson, and said, Bill, read this. It kind of reminds you of me, us a little bit. So Bill Wilson read this article. It dealt with an organization he'd never heard of called the Washingtonians. Apparently there'd been a movement just 100 years earlier, almost the same type of thing, where drunkards were helping drunkards, that had started with 6 low-class drunkards in Baltimore, gradually expanded to, by 1845, they had 100,000 members, it was assumed, in the United States, just all over. Unbelievable. Bill Wilson had never heard of that. He went to the library and found something on it and read about it and ran the article and realized, my God. And then in 1845, the Washingtonians realized how much they'd helped drunkards. They thought, God, if we can help drunkards, we should be able to help people with all kinds of problems. So they began to put their efforts elsewhere. Let's have a movement of stamping out the sale of alcohol. They don't have to worry about that. Let's work with narcotics addicts who are not alcoholics, not heroin and cocaine like today, but laudanum and opium. Let's get involved in the anti-slavery movement. Let's get involved in accepting Texas as a state. Let's get involved in all sorts of things. And they really put all their zip to it. And by 1848, the Washingtonians were extinct. With very few exceptions, they all died drunken bad deaths. I had a book home some years ago written in 1861 by one of its survivors. He said, I don't know what happened. We were doing so well, but people just got too busy to do what we were doing, and they were doing so many other good things, and we couldn't get along. No. And Bill Wilson read that and thought, my God, that's what's happening to us. He read about how they fought amongst themselves, how they fought who got the most publicity. They fought about money. They fought about who's going to be in charge. They fought about all these things, and one by one they just dissipated. And so, profiting from what he read and what he saw in the countless letters coming across his office, in a last gasp attempt to save Alcoholics Anonymous from this fate, he sat down and wrote the 12 Traditions in 1945. In the long form, not the way that we read tonight, but the long form. And he issued them one by one in the Grapevine, the new Grapevine, over a period of time, to show people what we have to do. And AA had one difficulty that we still have, and it's really, I don't know how we're ever going to surmount it. It's made up of alcoholics. And a great many people didn't want to, we don't want any more rules! We've come here to find love, goddammit! We don't want rules! Just another ploy by Bill Wilson, so Bill Wilson could take over. And so a lot of people didn't want to accept it, and they wouldn't accept it. And Bill Wilson spent 3 or 4 years riding around the East Coast on his motorcycle with his wife in a sidecar, trying to explain this to people. And they didn't want to hear it. I'll tell you, if you want to see something sad, there's some letters in the archives in New York. Groups that have invited Bill Wilson to speak at this period say, Bill would like to have you come and speak at our 2nd anniversary of our group, but only if you promise not to talk about the traditions. If you do, we don't want you. I mean, that's tough. And so Bill and Dr. Bob, oddly enough, they always got along well together. Their followers hated each other a lot, but they got along well. They decided, if we could just get some of these warring factions from around the country, from Houston and Los Angeles and New York and Chicago and San Francisco and Denver and Miami. If we could just get them in the same room, for God's sakes, we could explain the fact. So they decided to, they said to their followers, find us a place we can meet. And the people in Akron said, well, we'll go to a meeting, we will go to New York. And the people in New York, not to be outdone in spirituality, so we won't go to Akron. So Bill and Dr. Bob got together today, made a Solomon-like decision. Cleveland. Okay. So we all went to Cleveland in 1950. The first large group of sober alcoholics of our type staying sober in the same room in the history of the world. And I have a program from that, and I have the tapes of that convention. They're kind of poor quality now, but they're very interesting. Most of the speakers were non-alcoholics. They're trying to show how good AA was. The warden of San Quentin spoke, and some from the government health department spoke. And Bill and Dr. Bob spoke. And it's kind of interesting that Dr. Bob was dying of cancer. So they probably said, you probably don't want to speak, Bob. So I've got to talk. I'm sober 15 years next to Bill Wilson. That's the longest in the history of the world. I want to talk because he really had a zeal for AA. So that day, his son on one side and a friend on the other side took this tall, gaunt, dying man and brought him to the podium. And he gave a little talk. And he said, I want to welcome you all to Akron. I hope you'll go back and tell the boys, or Cleveland, I'll go back and tell the boys and girls in your groups that we're all here doing the same thing. And he said, I'm glad that some small thing I did 15 years ago helped bring this about. He said, I still get a thrill out of the fact that we all get out of AA what we put into it, according to our own zeal and efforts to put into it. He said, I want to apologize for my health, that I've been in bed most of the past few months. My health hasn't returned the way I thought it would. And And then he stopped for a moment. He said, but it has flashed in my mind that two or three things should be stressed. And then in the next 2 minutes or so, he gave what many people conceive to be the Ginsburg Address of Alcoholics Anonymous. It says, rings down the aisles, the roars of halls of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, first, let us remember to keep our program simple. Let's not louse it all up with Freudian complexes, which may be of interest to the scientific mind, but have nothing to do with our work here. Our 12 steps, when reduced to the last, consists of love and service. And we all know what love is, and we all know what service is. And secondly, he said, let us guard that erring member, the tongue, and try to use it with kindness and understanding and tolerance. And there isn't a person in this room or any room like it in the world who doesn't know exactly what he's talking about. We're all full of love and kindness and spirituality when things are going our way. So let somebody hurt your feelings or malign you or hurt you some way and just cut and slash. And finally he said, none of us would be here today if someone had taken the time to explain things to us, to give us a pat on the back when we needed it, take us to a few meetings. Let us never reach that stage of smug complacency where we are not willing to offer or attempt to offer to our less fortunate brothers the wonderful benefits that have been given to us. He said, that's it. And sat down, was dead shortly thereafter. And has always been the great hallmark of Alcoholics Anonymous. Such a beautiful thing. It's as true today as it ever was. And the Sober Convention, they had six young guys. You hear them on the tape. They're wonderful. You can just see their tails wagging, you know, talking about the traditions. And I've got these two traditions. I'll explain them. And they explained there weren't really rules. A has no way to enforce them, but just their suggestions. There's no AA police. Some of us think that's a mistake. You know, in my area, I have been known as a dictator-type sponsor. That is wrong, I suggest and share. But if I were a dictator-type sponsor, it always depends upon absolutely the permission of the dictatee. All he has to say is, screw you, and the dictatorship is over. It would be nice if we had police who could come at night and say, did you say screw you to your sponsor? Come with us to the camp for a while. But they explained it, and they took, they showed how the reason they were doing it. It was touching. At the end of this, Bill Wilson got up. Now, I understand this so well, I wish I didn't. He still was not sure that that would pass. What he said was, we've all heard the traditions read, seeing no objections, we accept them. won my heart. And so they came into our language, and they've been here a long time. We should talk a few minutes about the traditions. And the traditions are really nothing. I mean, the long form really explains them a little bit better. There's nothing really difficult about most of them. He wrote them in the order he thought they'd be necessary to save AA. We have to have unity, stop this damn fighting. And it's not to make me a dictator, so it's a group conscience, God speaking through group conscience. And there's no requirements. I'm not demanding any requirements. So all you need is we want to help all those who suffer from alcoholism. Later, convinced to say your only requirement is membership, stop drinking. And we can't tell the groups what to do, so every group's autonomous unless they're trying to affect AA. And our primary purpose is to carry the message who still suffers. And then we're not allied with anything financially, and we're not, and on, well, with the traditions. And there's no big deal in there. And yet, over the years, two or three traditions seem to be once in a while, incessantly under fire. And the ones under fire now are the fifth step and the third step as an adjunct to it, I think. A lot of places around the world where I travel, I hear people talk about the problems they're having in their groups. One reason, of course, is that they say, we're getting a lot of people in AA who are not alcoholics. They're maybe narcotics addicts, maybe gamblers, maybe just people. And we say, you can't come to a closed meeting. They say, oh, yes. He says, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. And I have a desire to stop drinking. Can't keep me out. And what do you do with a case like that? Of course, thank God, then you can go back to the long form of the traditions, where it says we want to help all those who suffer from alcoholism. When they condensed it to that form, they had no idea that someday non-alcoholics would try to sneak into AA. You can't get alcoholics in. Why would non-alcoholics want to come in? But to this day, it's amazing to find groups all over the country. They think a closed meeting just means that you maybe don't let passers-by come in. Anybody else can. Closed meetings seems to be what they are. It's closed meetings of alcoholics, of one alcoholic talks to another. Because the one so significant here, the one alcoholic service that makes it efficient. When you really think about it, there's only been, in all the 4,000 years of treatment of alcoholism, there's only been two times where there's been a place for people like you and me to go. One in the Washingtonians, one in Alcoholics Anonymous. And what do they have in common? The number one thing they have in common is one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic. Then the other tradition under fire, of course, is primary purpose to carry the message to the alcoholics who still suffers. And there's a great groundswell in many parts of AA around the world that is nice, but that's out of date. That's out of date. Today, many more young people are taking drugs and not so many into alcohol. And we're being too restrictive by saying you have to be an alcoholic to be an Alcoholics Anonymous member. And this is kind of, we're not meeting the need. It's all one big disease, so what the hell are we keeping people away from? And then we have to stop and think, why do we ask you to be an alcoholic, to be an Alcoholics Anonymous? And it gets back to the basic fact of our recovery. For one thing, let me put it this way. That phrase, it's all one big disease, you know where that comes from? It comes from a treatment center that only had one van. You have to look at the nature of alcoholism. What's the nature of alcoholism? What is the universal symptom of every alcoholic that ever lived down deep? I know you mean well, but my case is different. We all have had enough advice to last us 10,000 years from people who thought they knew what they could help us, and after a while you just shine them off. Thanks a lot for sharing. But you don't understand. My psychiatrist didn't understand. My doctor didn't understand. My father didn't understand. Nobody understood. I went to AA, they didn't understand. They thought stop drinking was going to make it better. Stop drinking makes it worse. Does anybody, drink is not my problem. I don't know, there's something wrong with me. And I don't want to talk about it because I had to disguise it. And how does that overcome? It's overcome by people talking to someone else, explaining emotions and feelings and experiences that that person thinks they're the only one that ever had. Well, how do you know about that? How do you know? And there's just maybe the first little twinge of, God, maybe I'm not so different. Maybe you take your arm and go, whoa, and let a few words in. And little by little, because that's this whole story of Alcoholics Anonymous from the beginning. From Bill Wilson talking to Dr. Bob and going up to talk to Bill W. In the hospital. One after one, as Dr. Bob said, we came out of that room with Bill Wilson. He said, my God, and he said to his wife, I've never heard a man who seemed to know how I drank before. It's the most amazing thing I've ever heard after 4 hours in that room. Up at the hospital with Bill D, he said, my wife made me talk to them fellas. And I didn't want to talk to them, but they came in and talked to me, and they never talked to me about my drinking once. They told me about their drinking and how they felt. I never heard anybody describe me like that. I was so impressed. I've been with them ever since. One after another, the whole concept of AA is that there's a place here where you can help people begin to realize they are not as different and alone as they think. That's why they say we are universally gifted. We have a gift that nobody else has. We can talk about feelings of difference and the reasons for that difference that nobody else in the world can talk about, and what drinking does to overcome it. And so it is, without that, it is just information. Everyone in this room has had enough advice to last them 10,000 years, as I said. But if you can find somebody who you believe knows how you feel, that becomes meaningful information. And you may do what they tell you just on the basis, my God, he knows how I feel. That's what happened to me after slipping for 10 years. I finally ran into a man who was able to talk to me and get me to believe he knew how I felt. And my life changed. And I was dying from alcoholism, and I knew as much about AA the day I got drunk the last time as I do now almost. I just never had done it because it wouldn't work for me anyway, because my case is different. They mean well. And little by little, this is such an important facet. You know, I've talked about this many times, but I don't know a better way to put it, to explain it to me. When I was about 2 years sober, I was really doing good now, really convert now, boy, I'm bright, I'm active, and I still didn't have any front teeth. I was wearing hand-me-down clothes, but by God, I was spiritual. I was talking to the 6300 WA Club one new meeting about obsessions. I'm the authority on obsessions. Not the recovery from them, just the obsessions. I gave a great talk on obsessions, and after the meeting, some plump lady came up and said, oh, that's just wonderful, Clancy. I never heard anybody discuss my obsessions before. She says, I've just started a new organization called Overeaters Anonymous. Would you come over Sunday and talk to our ladies? Sure I will, baby. I weighed 128 pounds, and I'll give them something to shoot for. And I went over there on Sunday when this room had about 8 fat women sitting around a table. But they were nice. I gave them a nice talk about obsessions. They all seemed to... And I sat down and knew I'd help them. But then they had a little sharing, and I couldn't believe my ears. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. Woman over here, her son's 10th birthday. He's in a military school, Long Beach. She sent her husband to get him, and she put out the cake, the 2-layer cake that she'd made for his birthday. And she was so excited. She just took a little taste to make sure it was all right. Then another little taste. By the time they got home, the cake was gone. And she felt so terrible. I didn't say anything because I'm too nice a guy, but I thought, Jesus, just take a piece of cake and have a go with that. What the hell's wrong with you? Yeah. Woman over here talks about eating ice cream. She eats ice cream. I just got to have my ice cream. I can't go without it. I eat it every day, and a lot of ice cream. And I just love it. My husband's so upset, but I love it. And I didn't say anything because I'm too nice a guy. But I could have said, no wonder you're fat, for Christ's sake. Anybody would be fat eating ice cream like that, you know. Just eat a bowl of ice cream and let it go with that. Over here, some woman talked about eating till she couldn't eat anymore, then put her finger down the throat and vomited up so she could eat some more. And I thought, don't bother shaking hands with me after the meeting. I can see doing that for drinking, but not eating. I've done it for drinking a lot. Oh, my God, it's Saturday afternoon. I'm drunk already. Now, what was the difference? Nothing. I understood exactly what they were saying, but I didn't identify. It was just information. And that is why members of AA, who also, a member of AA, Jim Willis, a friend of mine, who also had a gambling problem, would bring his gambler's friends to AA, and they didn't get much help. So he became the first person to write to New York and get permission to use the 12 steps and founded Gamblers Anonymous, which became the most successful of all the non-AA 12-step movements, although Cocaine Anonymous is overtaking it now. It's all over the world, very successful. Build Jim Willis's picture on the wall like we have Bill Wilson. And in the mid-1960s, Jim was married to Sybil Willis, now Sybil Corwin, of course, and got so active in GA that he didn't have time for AA anymore. So he was very sad when he got drunk and died. But he, as they say in GA, he never gambled again. And that's all they cared about. Got some guys in North Hollywood, wrote New York, got the permission to use the 12 steps for Narcotics Anonymous, which became the number two one. Then this woman became number three with her Overeaters Anonymous. Then Cocaine Anonymous, number four. All of these came out of West LA and North Hollywood within a period of 2 years. And they all were based on one thing. So they could identify. The recovery might be all the same, but unless I identify, the recovery will never get in because it'll bounce right off my feeling of difference. To this day, you know, I've been working with addicts for over 30 years, on a daily basis almost. I know as much about addiction, I'm sure, as most addicts will ever learn in their life. But when I go to a meeting, and I sit there, and somebody talks for an hour about shooting up or sniffing up, whatever it is they do, it's just information, and I leave just evaluating their presentation. But what I need to hear some goof get up there. I've been drinking a lot because it makes me feel like I'm something. And now I'm really screwed. I've come to AA and I've got a sponsor. And he makes me go to meetings every night. I'm starting to feel better. Jesus. Yeah. I know the feeling, baby. I know the feeling. That's why we have to remember. You know, I have three daughters who are just turned 16 this year in AA. I have a grandson who's a year sober in AA. I've got two great-grandsons, one of whom is either a potential alcoholic or the spawn of the devil. I look at the back of his neck constantly for see if there's a 666 appearing. Everything you set down, you might as well say goodbye to it because you're never going to see it again. But when I had a little snuggle, he's only five, I can't really tell yet. But I know when the day comes when he wants to come to Alcoholics Anonymous, he's been drinking, I hope he walks into a room that is made up of people like there are in this room tonight, wherever it may be, whether it may be in Montana or Virginia or the Dakotas or Las Vegas or wherever the hell you're from. I hope he walks into a room where they're talking about identification and recovery. Recovery without identification seems to be absolutely worthless for people of our type. That is the only thing that was missing in all the treatments of alcoholics like us for 4,000 years. Nobody ever thought maybe one of them should talk to another one of them. And that's why it works so well. And you know, it's an amazing thing. You sometimes think, as I listen, to be very honest with you, I know all the speakers that have spoken. I know them all well. Didn't know Ralph quite as well, but I know Sharon, I know Clint, and I know Sandy, and I certainly know Tom. And these are great AA members, and they are great enunciators of the AA message. And sometimes when I hear great enunciators like that, I feel ill at ease almost, because they seem to have reached a stage of spiritual grace that I have not yet reached. I have not reached that stage of grace that enables me to know exactly what the problem and so on. And sometimes I struggle with myself and trouble my emotion. I've come a different, maybe I'd say, well, it's because I slipped so many years, I had to overcome all that. I didn't did nothing to do that at all. It's just that I sometimes think of that, and then I have to, if you're like me, there's a couple things you might take comfort in. One, of course, is that paragraph in chapter 5 after they read the 12 steps, where they say no one has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is we're willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. And even more significantly, Bill Wilson, a much flawed man, we write books about how flawed he was, yet he's responsible for us being in this room tonight. But one of the more touching things I've ever read about Bill Wilson, in late 1959, some members in Chicago wrote him a letter. Said, "We are really disillusioned with you, Bill. Your behavior is not up. You're supposed to be acting better." He hadn't done things so grievously, but they thought he had. "And we're disillusioned with you." And he wrote a letter back to them, which I found in the archive some years ago. It's a touching letter. You may identify with it. I identify with it a great deal. Not as funny as you think. "That you seem disillusioned with me personally may be a new and painful experience for you. But many members have had that experience with me. Most of their pain has been caused not only by my several shortcomings, but by their own insistence on placing me, a drunk, trying to get along with other folks, upon a completely illusory pedestal, a station which no fallible person could possibly occupy. I'm sure you will understand that I've never held myself out to anybody as either a saint or a superman. I've repeatedly and truthfully said that AA is full of people who have made more spiritual progress than I ever have or can. That in some areas of living I have made some decided gains. That in others I have seemed to have stood still. And in still other ways, I may have even gone backward. I am sorry you are disillusioned, but I am happy that even I have found a life here." And that is, you must remember that in the days, because I'm sure whatever ideals we have and what we try to achieve, most of us will have days of feeling weak and heavy laden, as the Bible used to talk about people like me. And I come from a strong religious ethic, and I see my shortcomings, and I see them very clearly, and I work on them. And I sometimes think, when will I ever reach that stage where it's going to be wonderful? Then I realize I have never felt better longer in the history of my life. That's what it's about, to live with some degree of comfort in the world without you. Some unresolved problems, some situations I don't know what to do about. And yet I sleep well, and I feel well, and I try to be of service to others to the best of my ability. And that's the great miracle of alcoholics and the bottom line of Alcoholics Anonymous. You don't become a saint. You don't become wonderful. You improve. Some people improve more than I ever will. But I improve more than I ever have. And you can too, I believe. And that's why we have to go back and make sure that our groups maintain the traditions, not because they're wonderful, but because our salvation depends on them. So many times in the world, the traditions are used just to have some newcomer read them, see if he can pronounce autonomous. No. And yet our life depends on them. Group after group who have flaunted them have died. The largest group in New York City, Midtown Group. I spoke there 25 years ago. Jam! Just four people! And they took the position, well, we really should acknowledge the fact there's more narcotics use than there used to be. And so they begin having a narcotic speaker every week and an alcoholic speaker the next week and a narcotic speaker. They go to NA dances and AA dances. And I went there to spoke and it seemed to be a cacophony. And 2 years later they were extinct. They've been extinct ever since. Because there seems to be a universal truism amongst people like us. A meeting where anything goes is eventually a meeting where nobody goes. Because the meat and potatoes are there. We may desire and think we want the meringue, but down here we want the bread and potatoes and meat of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I think it's a good thing to remember where we came from. All those funny little coincidences fell into place. thank God Dr. Jung turned him away. And thank God he decided to go to the Oxford group. And thank God the Oxford group was in the only period of its existence where Bill and Dr. Bob both were members of it, could go. Any other time they wouldn't have ever met. And where they, little by little, Bill took steps that changed our lives. And Dr. Bob took steps. And little by little, all a bunch of dumb little things and people. And they just so incredibly, incredibly just right for that moment. So here we are tonight. And the biggest fight we have to in our lives, to not take it for granted. To believe in it. To pass it along. To listen to wonderful speakers like we're listening to this weekend. Not only listen to them and be enthralled, but go back home and keep that pocket of enthusiasm bubbling so that people like you and me can come as long as we exist. Thank you.
And strongest voices for the ethic of Alcoholics Anonymous and the preservation of its principles, Clancy I from Venice, California.
My name is Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm very glad to be here tonight, glad to be part of this retreat. I was a little doubtful about it when Bob called me about it, but it's much better than he described it. It's been a remarkable weekend. We've had some outstanding talks. Sandy, last night, talking on the steps. I always admire his command of thought and language and his ability to express it in analogies that are quite clear. And this morning, enjoyed very much hearing the Hispanic lady. I wouldn't mention her name. She's gone home. She's ill. She told me, she sent me a note. And she's ill, and she's Angie, dear lady. She has bad asthma. And she went home. But she was here, and Ralph gave such an outstanding talk this morning. Where's he now? He's gone too? God, they're piling out of here like rats. You can bet Tom Ivester's here. Because he's going to talk next, that's why. Anyway. And Clint gave a fine talk today on the sixth and seventh steps, and very much enjoyed Sharon's talk on the steps. And this is all very nice. You say, isn't that beautiful speakers? In fact, it would be nice if they had a lineup of speakers like that at the International Convention instead of what they have. They had Tom, but that's a start. But they need a little more than, they should get people like they've had today and tonight and last night. But that's not the impressive thing about this. I go to places, a lot of places, I hear great speakers, and I have some wonderful speakers that are inspiring and so on. You can hear them a lot of places. What's inspiring about this place is that the attenders are all on the same page. There's never been anything like that, as far as I know, in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, where there's been hundreds of people, all activists from far and near, who all believe in the same general principles and are getting together to enhance their belief and to associate with one another. This is absolutely a remarkable one-time thing, and we're all very fortunate to be here. And we can hang it on Bill Wilson's birthday tomorrow, whatever we hang it on. But it is it's a remarkable thing. And I know there's some newer people here. I just want to talk for just a few minutes, a little bit, about how lucky we are to be here. Most of us know this, you know, but there seem to be types of alcoholics. We don't talk about it much, but there are types. There seems to be a type of alcoholic. By any way you measure them, they're alcoholic. They drink, and they get in trouble, they can't stop. And something happens that really threatens their security. Maybe a death in the family, or lose a job, or lose a family. And they quit! And they never drink again. And there's all kinds of people roaming around like that. And the same type of people, when they become addicted to alcohol, need medical withdrawal. These are the people for whom treatment centers were originally created. And these people sometimes don't understand how lethal alcoholic addiction is, much more lethal than drug addiction. Has been said by authorities, you put 50 alcoholics, addicted alcoholics, and 50 addicted drug addicts in a room, and in 10 days you open that door, you're going to have 50 awfully sick drug addicts and about 25 dead alcoholics. Because that's where all the terrible things that happen, the spasms, the attacks, the delirium tremens, all the various things that happen. But these people go to treatment centers and they're led by one step by step, withdrawn from their alcohol addiction. They're shown the error of their ways and they quit and they never drink again. In fact, up in Seattle, Chic Shadel, very famous hospital, advertises that, and they do it. They're absolutely correct. They say, we will remove your alcoholism in less than 30 days. And they do it. They have a long list of names for whom they've done it. People like us, gay as a gas tenant. How could that be? Because that's a type of alcoholic. Then there's another type of alcoholic, which seems to be an alcoholic by any way you measure it. They drink too much or they can't stop drinking. They have problems. And something happens that really threatens their security and they quit. But they always eventually drink again, sooner or later. And this same type of alcoholic comes out of treatment centers with tears of sincerity rolling down their cheeks, and they know they've had enough, but they eventually always drink again and again and again. And these are the type of alcoholics that have baffled science and medicine and psychology and psychiatry and families most often, I suppose. I've often thought most everyone in this room, I'm sure, who's an alcoholic has studied that phenomenon of looking at someone's face who loves you and seeing that terrible look of disappointment. And that, oh, how could you? You were doing so well. And the children were doing better. And now look at you. How could you do that? And that really rips you up. So you have to say things like, oh, shut up and leave me alone, God damn it. It sounds funny, but it isn't funny at all. It's the cry of someone who does know. I'm saying, I don't know either. I don't know either. Leave me alone. And these are the people that for written records of 4,000 years have baffled everybody. One time they thought they were possessed by the devils and somebody would be put to death and flogged and whipped and put in prisons and jails and nut houses, and England would send them to colonies, send them to Australia, get them out of here. Just, there's no hope for these type of people. And when I was born, and a little boy in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, after 4,000 years, there still was no place for people like this to be helped. There's the Keeley cure, where they made you sick by drinking, but you stopped, you know, as soon as you found a place where they didn't put stuff in the booze, you could drink again. And they never had any cure. And that's the background of this strange story that we've heard a couple. Sanders told a little bit last night, I'll just tell you a little bit tonight, about this family in New York, very wealthy family, manufacturing family, had a big manufacturing firm. They had a son who's going to take over the firm. And he seemed to be troubled by nerves, a nervous disease of some sort. He'd get terribly nervous. And when he got terribly nervous, he would drink, and he would drink too much. And his parents thought, if we could get rid of this nervous condition, we'll probably be able to help him. And so most of us know the story, but here's a little Philip you may not know. They decided to contact the best doctor in the world to help him. And the first one they contacted was Dr. Freud. And Dr. Freud refused to take the case. And that's the first break we ever got. We could be sitting here tonight drunk and saying, but I dreamt I was sober. Instead, they went to see Dr. Jung. They had a couple friends take him to Dr. Jung in Switzerland, and Dr. Jung, as Sandy told us so well last night, put him in a sanitarium and worked with him every day to break through the walls that were causing this emotional upset, his conflicts. And at the end of a year, he felt he had really understood the nature of his problem, sent him home, and he went to stopped in Paris before he took the ship with some wealthy members of his friends of his family, and they toasted his new life. And 3 days later, he was drunk, face down again. Nobody could understand why. He was supposed to be all well. So they took him back to Dr. Jung and said, we don't know what happened to Roland, but he seemed to have a little upset. And Dr. Jung, as we know, refused to take him back, which was a funny little break for us. I'll tell you, if he'd have taken him back, we might not be here today. But he didn't take him back. And he said, Roland, I have misdiagnosed your case. He said, in effect, I thought I could help you with the deep-seated emotional problems you had, but I see now that you are what is known as a chronic alcoholic. And to the best of my knowledge, there is no effective treatment for your condition today in the world at any price. Now, this is a bad piece of news to get. And Roland said, well, what does this mean, doctor? And the doctor said, what it means, Roland, he said, in effect, you must either keep yourself confined for the rest of your life, or you almost certainly will intermittently drink to excess until you die or go mad. And Roland said, my God, is there any way out? And the doctor said, yes, in my readings, I read of some cases where there's been some sort of involuntary psychological reversion. They call it a spiritual experience. He said, very rare, very hard to get. I wouldn't plan that you'd look for one. I suggest that you do what I say, Roland. And Roland came home. He didn't stop in Paris for dinner this time. And he got in the ship, and on that ship, he apparently did what all of us have to do somewhere along the line, although we don't know it. He surrendered to the fact that he had no hope. And he cast about. It just started a series of funny little coincidences. Any one of them, if they hadn't happened just the way they did, we wouldn't be here tonight. That's what's so spooky about it. He was a vestryman of the Presbyterian Church. And he'd been very active in church work. And yet he thought, how can I get to be one of these spiritual, at least a spiritual degree? And there was a thing called the Oxford Movement going on. And it was a kind of a big fad at the time. What most of us don't know is that it was the only period of its success in that decade. There's not before or since. What happened was, in 1912, a Lutheran minister in Pennsylvania felt that the Christians of the world were not devoting enough of their lives to Christianity, were not willing to take inconvenience and pain. And he wanted them to be like the Christians in the first century who would be willing to be crucified for their belief. And he started an organization called the First Century Christian Association. And it didn't go over very well. You know, who wants to be crucified? But it was a lot of rigorous application. But later on, he went to England and tried to peddle it. And for some reason or other, the students and faculty at Oxford University really were fascinated by it. And they took it on as their will. And it became known as the Oxford Group, the Oxford Movement. And he brought it back to the United States in the late 1920s as the Oxford Group. Now it had a little panache, a little something to go with it. And all over the country for the next few years, small, growing numbers of small groups of well-to-do, intelligent people would get together and discuss spiritual values. The best equivalent I can think of, if any of you are old enough to remember the Earhart Seminar Training, where people would get together and discuss psychological things. These are spiritual things, and they were fine people. And they were really quite advanced. They weren't people coming off the street. And in fact, 1929 is when they first began to take hold of the United States again. By 1937, they were almost extinct because the minister had been fascinated by the way Germany seemed to be so efficient, and he admired them, so the Oxford people asked him to stop using his name because he was such a German believer, they thought. And he changed his name to the Moral Rearmament Movement, and still little tiny dribblets today. But in that nine-year period, it really functioned and flourished. And if it hadn't, we wouldn't be here. But anyway, he decided to go join the Oxford Movement. And he wrote later, he said, I wanted to stay sober as long as I could. So my parents, when I died, my parents would have a memory of me being sober. Which sounds kind of tough. And a few years later, when he died drunk, his parents had a memory of me being sober for quite a while. But he got active in the Oxford Movement and really enjoyed it and did very well and has got it back into business and doing well and helping people. And his family were so pleased. They said, you know, you're doing so well. Why don't you take some time off and go up to Vermont, our country home where we used to have always spent our summers. And he went up to Vermont and he had a good time, saw some old friends. And he came back to New York to pick up some affairs. Then he went back to Vermont. And he got there just the nick of time. If he'd have waited one more week, we wouldn't be here. It's just scary. Because when he got there this time, they said, you know, our childhood friend that you knew when you visited up here as a child, Evie,